Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Wrap. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and I'm joined today by Mr. Terence Corrigan. I just want to firstly say a thank you to everyone who looked after the show while I was away. I'm in Pretoria, McCorney, and everyone else. I really do appreciate that. I unfortunately broke my arm rather badly and spent a while in hospital, but I'm now back. So let us get into the news of today. And Terence, the first thing we're going to be talking about is the provincial government of Gauteng is in a little bit of money trouble. Apparently, the provincial government of Gauteng says that by the end of May, they had only collected 9% of the total revenue that they had budgeted to collect in the 2025-2026 financial year. They're planning to collect 8.4 billion rand, and they've only managed to collect 750 million rand. So not a great number. Provincial governments make most of their money from taxing gambling, liquor licenses, interest and surplus funds, and most importantly, motor vehicle license fees. And so in an effort to try and recover the situation, the Gauteng provincial government says it's going to be turning to its own employees, who it says owe it 308 million rand at the beginning of the financial year. And they hope that they will be able to extract this money with the use of various debt collectors. So it's not just the local governments in places like Joburg, which seem to be in financial trouble, but also now the Gauteng provincial government seems to be in a lot of issues. Terence, what do you make of this? This seems, shall we say, in one word, not good, or two words, not good. But you know, I think you mentioned in the pre-show discussion, this says something about how bad debt is across the country.
Yeah, look, I think there's two issues which are fairly separate. One is that this is a kind of expression of the asymmetric nature of federalism in the country, that the power of the purse was retained very, very firmly at national level, while certain functions were devolved. So, yeah, quasi-federal is the best descriptor you can give this, and this has left left provincial governments fairly vulnerable. As you say, there's the abattoirs and casinos that they can go after, but not much more. But yeah, the biggest story here is that the middle class in South Africa is stressed beyond breaking point. The need to tap your employer as a source of credit, which is not unique to government, it's private sector operators have the same problem. And you know, even going down to your sort of domestic worker space, although that's obviously not the middle class. Point is, though, that in order to maintain a middle-class lifestyle, or maintaining a middle-class lifestyle in South Africa, is simply becoming prohibitive. And I think for civil servants, there's something else that most of them are African or black, with extended family responsibilities called the so-called black tax. These tend to be people who are either in the first or maybe the second generation of wealth, and there are a lot of calls on that. You find that in order to keep up the lifestyle that your salary makes possible for you, you're having to tap into a lot, you know, into more and more, you know, sort of sources of funds, lending, credit cards, etc. And this is not a great situation. You know, we've seen some evidence of increasing defaults on this. Governments, I think, would have a particular problem though, because there's a lot of politics involved when you start to actually try to discipline somebody. What, you know, someone who just doesn't pay back. Well, I suppose you could put a garnish on the salary, but that's going to create, well,
one of the disturbing details in the story was that one of the things that had held the government back from collecting some of this debt was they had to garnish a bunch of pensions, which kind of speaks to how sort of bad and old some of these debts might be.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. Look, I remember issues around this were being raised tentatively back in the 1990s. Now, it was a different thing there. This was like your very first flash of let's say, post-apartheid civil servants. And many of these people were moving into a middle-class lifestyle for the first time ever in their family tree. And it was things like, you know, borrowing money to buy a suburban house and to get that out with a lounge suite and kitchen appliances or whatever. And you sort of turn around and you realize, you know, wow, you've kind of sunk yourself for the next couple of years. What looks like a huge amount of money on paper, particularly when you have nothing to compare it to. And I certainly can attest to that, you know, thinking that I had more money than God when I, you know, when I got my first paycheck. Top tip, it was 3,500 rand. and it was more money than I'd ever seen before. But the thing is that, you know, your appetite for all those lovely consumer goods drains that very, very quickly. And as I say, particularly when you have a social or a family system that also has a certain claim or entitlement on your income, and you know, unless you can get that economy to expand and you know take that sort of pressure off, also you know questions of financial literacy, money doesn't last forever.
Like This makes our middle class very vulnerable to basically slipping out of the middle class, especially when, as you say, you don't have the economic growth to sort of kind of keep you going. I mean, if the economy keeps growing, if more people are getting into jobs, if people's salaries are tending to go up, then it doesn't, you know, debt, it's like a problem, but it's a manageable problem. It's one you can sort of work around. But when things are stagnant, when things are frozen, as they have been for sort of 15 years or so now, do put this great risk. And that's why even the gains we have made since 94 could be reversed if we don't get that economic train moving.
Right. Well, you know, let me just bring us to a conclusion that, you know, we have the same problem with politicians, people who's the difference between living in an informal settlement and living in the suburbs is that civil servant's job, that seat in parliament or, you know, the local council. That's why these things, can become so cutthroat. And compare that to, you know, mature democracies where people will often have some sort of career to fall back on, although this professionalization is a problem. And a particularly amusing story I remember once hearing was that there was a Canadian politician who had been quite prominently got voted out, and he was tracing, what are you doing now? He's running, he's a night manager in a strip club. But, you know, it's good, honest work.
Yes. All right, let's move on to our next story. And Terence, this is, you've written a column, which I don't think it's been published yet, but it will be out soon, about... And I think we've covered this story a couple of times on the show before about the South African hostility towards Taiwan and specifically the location of its liaison office. But I just want to tie it to another story, which is that there was a story that appeared in News 24 that the city of Tshwane was thinking about maybe renting out the city hall, which has been sort of derelict for a while now, to the Iranian embassy. And this was sort of not confirmed, denied by all the parties involved. But there was a tweet by a city official which seemed to indicate that they were showing the Iranian embassy around City Hall. So let's just say that if in considering our current diplomatic situation with the United States, this is perhaps not a great thing, which is why I suspected why everyone is currently denying that it ever took place and why it probably won't happen. But you know, do you want to just talk about what happened with the Taiwan office and maybe how?
Yeah, look, I will encourage everyone to please, you know, tune into the Daily Friend on Monday because you'll be able to read my opus there. But basically, there was a statement put out in the Government Gazette by the Department of International Relations and Cooperations. No such body existing in the South African state. It's the International Relations and Cooperation, singular, but, you know, indicating that from the 31st of March, They will no longer recognize that being 4 months ago. But, you know, like the dysfunction in that statement, I think, very much describes the dysfunction in our diplomacy. But yeah, you know, South Africa has no official relations with Taiwan. So to my mind, it's a matter of no great importance whether they locate their offices in Pretoria or in Guruman. The South African government isn't dealing with this, but this is a sort of petty, vindictive, you know, look how chummy we are with China, that we want this China pretender out. Now, what strikes me about this, well, there's a few things going on, and I confess, you know, to being very sympathetic to Taiwan for various personal reasons, but that's a relationship that could have continued, you know, unofficially or short of diplomatic relations, cordially and respectfully. But there is a, as I say, it's a type of petty vindictiveness, you know, to say, look how chummy we are with the People's Republic. Now, it does suggest to me that, you know, when we talk about our sovereignty being non-negotiable, that's a flexible concept. Our relationship with the PRC has also been one for which South Africa has been willing to throw out, even rhetorically, some of its commitments. It goes right back to the 1990s where Aziz Pahad said, we can all agree, all of us, of course, that not all human rights are universal. Now, it seems to me if a human right is not universal, it's not a human right. And that was in response to China. Multilateralism is imperative when talking about the Middle East, but not so much when talking about the South China Sea. But what I doubt very much there is an appreciation of, just because I don't think that we have, you know, the caliber of thinking in our diplomatic corps, is that there are plenty of countries that do not have formal relations with Taiwan, but whose security is very closely tied to it. I'm thinking of Japan. I'm thinking of the Philippines. Even countries like Australia and Vietnam, you know, Vietnam being ideologically very different, but they all have one thing in common, that they are very wary of the other China. Ceding Taiwan to the People's Republic, for instance, basically allows it to choke South Korea and Japan. This is the area where a shooting war could actually, you know, between the peers could perhaps break out. I don't think this has gone unnoticed with the Americans. It's not like South Africa is sort of washing its hands of it and say, well, we don't have anything to do there, since South Africa has no influence. It's saying that we fully side with our brothers in the Chinese Communist Party. And when you know, the prospect of the USS Ronald Reagan, you know, steaming into a hail of anti-ship missiles, or, you know, Japanese fighter pilots taking off from Osaka base, or Filipino Marines in the you know, the mischief shoals and whatever, this isn't just about making some sort of bold, you know, look at my G-string comment about, you know, to the American imperialists. This is about, you know, how you structure your relationship with that whole region. Before I get into Taiwan is a democracy. Let's just not forget that little fact.
Yeah, no, I mean, we're so far away in our foreign policy from any sort of consistency on our supposed commitment to human rights or supporting human rights. We can't even start that discussion, I think. But the president today speaking about, you know, kind of made this sort of offhand comment about how, you know, we don't really understand why the U.S. is so hostile to us. Well, guys, maybe this is why. Maybe it's the fact that the, you know, city governments are thinking about renting out City Hall to Tswane. Maybe it's because we're naming you know, roads after Palestinian terrorists. Maybe it's because, you know, Taiwan is being, you know, sort of antagonized for no particular reason. It's not like we're getting anything from this. It's not like the Chinese state is going to be investing 100 billion rand in the country because of this. Just, you know, because we could. It just speaks to the kind of just sheer incompetence of the ANC sort of political strategy, I guess.
Let me bring that one full circle. When our former foreign minister went to try and repair relations in America shortly before the last election. Now, when you're sending the Lady Pandora to try and repair your relations with America, there's already just so many problems with that statement, but, you know, let's leave. She did a talk at some think tank, and she was asked, you know, about the approach to Iran. She said, we don't have a definition of authoritarian. You know, I don't know. I'm reminded of a statement that I think I've used in the show before: too stupid to survive. And I don't know. Maybe that's just where our diplomacy is. You know, maybe we shouldn't attribute to ideology what can just be explained by sheer incompetence. That it's not that we were snubbing America, but that the official didn't check his inbox for the email. I wouldn't be surprised, but you put these things together. Let's just say it's a troublesome brew.
Yes, indeed. All right. Then some sort of local political news from by-elections. This is, I think, a bit of a shock for the DA, which it's the Drakenstein municipality near Paarl. The DA has lost a ward in a by-election in the area. This is what makes this noteworthy is that this was a ward that used to be pretty solidly DA. As recently as, I think, 2021, it voted sort of 58% for the DA, with the Patriotic Alliance only got around 1%. The ANC was the second biggest party with kind of around sort of 12-ish% of the vote. In 2024, there were signs that the PA was picking up steam in this ward. The DA won 55% of the vote, so only very slightly down, but the PA had gone up to 20% of the vote. And now, in the by-election held yesterday, the PA won the ward with 43% of the vote, the DA's 39% of the vote. So it's still very close. As far as I can tell from looking up this ward, it's not like a huge number of voters. So it's that's perhaps part of the reason why there's been this dramatic swing. But this does seem to be a continuing problem for the DA. It keeps losing by-elections to the Patriotic Alliance. Now, you know, there are places where the DA has managed to fend off the PA in by-elections, but there's an awful lot where they have lost by-elections to the PA. And I think it speaks to the fact that the DA, which used to, I think, have a really, really strong by-elections infrastructure, is just not able to fight these by-elections as well as it used to. And, well, obviously, Gate McKenzie has proved that he has worked out how to be a political superstar of a sort. What's your take on this, Terrence?
Look, I would be concerned if I was the DA. That being said, I think that one needs to reserve judgment because by-elections are often locally determined, and they take place in the absence of all the hype that surrounds even a general local government election. I think that what the PA has been able to bring to bear is a very specific bespoke offering to coloured South Africans, brown people, if you like. And that is something that Gayton McKenzie is sometimes open about, sometimes coy about, but I think that is very much the narrative that goes that goes through it. And I think that he's able to capture and channel dissatisfaction and give it an identity. You know, it's in some places, this might be about foreigners, which is, you know, another bugbear of his. But I think that for a particular part of the coloured electorate, there's that sense, not white enough, not black enough. You know, uses voting fodder by everyone, and he at least comes and sort of is able to, or his machine can actually, you know, address them in very specific terms. This is going to be about you and no one else. You know, you're not going to have to share the limelight. And then, as you say, charismatic leadership. I would say, though, that in South Africa, that has a, for the most part, that has a limited lifespan. I'm thinking, for instance, Thabo Mbeki, for instance, when he took over, was viewed as the man who was going to revolutionize South Africa. Ended up with people baying for his blood and accusing him of genocide. Helen Zille remember when she took over from Tony Leon, you know, such a breath of fresh air, and, you know, this is a revolution the DA needs. And, you know, now many of those same people say that she's as toxic as they come. Jacob Zuma, I think, is somebody who, for his constituency, has been able to keep it. Ramaphosa, I think, is now uniformly disappointing. So I think that there is a that there is a lifespan on how far you can spin that. And I think that there might be a bit of a sugar high effect to this, that, yes, you can get people to vote for you, but then you have to actually deliver something to them. It's not clear what the PA can deliver. I mean, there's been stories about promises of jobs that didn't materialize. I don't know how true that is, but, you know, certainly those are claims that have been made. We shall see.
I think it is something to watch. And I'm curious to see whether, as you say, you know, the PA is able to hold on to the ground that it has captured, not just make inroads in places that it hasn't won yet. There have been some places, but it does look like the PA's momentum has sort of, where it's done well previously, has slowed, perhaps because, you know, it's not the shiny new kid on the block anymore, which is, you know, always a benefit when you come in and you don't have expectations.
One comment I heard from a seasoned observer was that the PA's image with particularly with colored folks in the Western Cape is very much kind of tied to the sort of gangster bling lifestyle. You know, the you know, not in terms of going and shooting people, but, you know, in terms of, you know, the conspicuous consumption, the get rich quick, you know, rude behavior, that sort of thing. And apparently this is very appealing to, you know, to certain people and very off-putting to others. So, you know, I think that you know, you play that card, it brings you a particular constituency which might, you know, be fairly loyal, but I think it can also exercise an alienating effect as well.
I think that's a really good point, and that's exactly why, you know, while sometimes it's useful to use kind of racial blocks and things to examine elections, at the end of the day, you know, these are not real kind of serious sort of groups. They are much more intricate internally. Like, there's no such thing really in South Africa as quote unquote the black vote. There is, and this huge diversity of, you know, professions and beliefs and value systems and things within that. And I think exactly in that analysis there, you kind of see that, you know, there are some colored voters who are very much keen on what the PA is selling. And there are some who say, no ways at all do we want this. But yeah, a big problem for the DA, and we'll have to see where this goes from now. But anyway, thank you very much.
It was said of Jesse Jackson, his great appeal was his race, his rhetoric, and his repertoire. The great turnoffs, his race, his rhetoric, and his repertoire.
Yeah, okay. Anyway, so we'll have to see how this develops and whether the DA is able to stem the tide in the next local government election, and perhaps they will be. I think it's going to be very interesting to see if there is indeed a difference in performance between by-elections and the sort of, you know, national local government election. Maybe the PA will not be able to carry on. Anyway, we'll see what happens. Thanks very much, everyone, for watching. Sorry if I was a bit off my game today. I'm still kind of getting better, but hopefully it wasn't too all over the place. Thanks very much, everyone, and have a wonderful day. Cheers.
The Daily Friend Show and The Daily Friend are a project of the Institute of Race Relations, the IRR. The IRR is a think tank which was founded in 1929 to study race relations in South Africa and works to change government policy to improve race relations through non-racialism and to ensure the prosperity of all South Africans. If you like our work and would like to support us, please go to irr.org.za and click Support the IRR. Or you can go to thedailyfriend.co.za and click the Fund Us button.